the bottom line of Hollywood. The problem with Hollywood and the success of Hollywood are the same. Hollywood is making more and more money every year, so why should they change? But once the bottom line is affected, then Hollywood will change.
They say theirs. Filmmaker Stanley Nelson, director of Black Panther's Vanguard of the Revolution. It airs on PBS on February 16th. His other films include Freedom Riders and Freedom Summer. Still with us here in Park City, Utah, is Don Porter, the director of Trapped, which just had its world premiere here at the Sundance Film Festival. And she has directed other films, Gideon's Army, Spies of Mississippi. Your response here, Don, you know, when you saw the announcements of the Oscars, all 20 actors and actresses, not one a person of color.
Mm-hmm. You know, it goes beyond actors and actresses. I mean, I think there's also an appalling lack of recognition of screenwriters, of directors. I have to say that the day the Academy nominations came out, I had such a sinking feeling of despair. I really was hopeful last year with the Oscars So White hashtag, with the conversation, with everybody's pledges to do better. Not only did they not do better, they did worse. How could it possibly be that in a year when so much fine work is emerging from actors, directors, producers, writers of color, that not any, that no one is recognized for their artistic achievements? And I think that that's a real problem.
There are feeders into the Oscars, like Sundance. Now, while there's the hashtag Oscars so white, at Sundance, it's Sundance not so white. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that's true?
I feel it's absolutely true. I mean, you see coming into, in the documentary competition, which my film is competing, in which Trapped, which Gideon's Army competed 3 years ago, there 40% directors of the directors are women. And in you also have, but and you have directors of color, but you see, once you move through that pipeline, those people disappear. It's as if, you know, Sundance didn't happen. So a film festival, it is one of the premier film festivals in the country. Where is all that talent being recognized?
Do you support a boycott of the Oscars?
I absolutely support a boycott. You know, this reminds me of when baseball was segregated, you know, the Negro Leagues. Does anyone really think that all of the talent that was in the sport was being recognized? How can you possibly look at the films that are coming out and think that the best, you know, the Oscars are supposed to represent the best of what we have to offer? How can that possibly be if no, none of these fine films are recognized?
And Spike Lee's comment that it's about the gatekeepers.
I think it absolutely is about the gatekeepers, but I don't think we should absolve the voting members of the Academy. I think that there's a real focus on there.
Dawn Porter, thanks so much. Her film is called Trapped. It airs on PBS on
in June.
In June, and we will talk about it when it's coming out. That does it for our show. Very happy birthday to Tarina Nadura. Democracy Now! Has two job openings, Director of Finance and Operations and Development Director. Visit democracynow.org for more information. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Malkoff, Ravi Karan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Our website is democracynow.org.
Trying to make a living.
Blues, Barbecue, and Brews, a musical evening benefiting All Souls Unitarian Church and KKFI. The performances by Danny Cox and Bob Walkenhorse and the Shawnee Mission East Jazz Band. Saturday, January 30th from 6 to 9 p.m., 4500 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. Doors at 5:30, music at 6, dinner served at 6:15. Donation of $25 includes all the music and all you can eat. For just $20, all the music you can hear. Advance tickets available at All Souls Unitarian Church, 10 to 2, Monday through Friday, or at 816-531-2131. Benefiting KKFI and All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. At Blues, Barbecue, and Brews on January 30th at 6 p.m. Come on out.
This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's edition of Jaws of Justice Radio, host Melvin Merritt checks in with 22nd District Representative Brandon Ellington on the start of the Missouri legislative session and what to expect in the coming months. Then, in the second half, Keith Brown Ill talks with Caroline McGinnis about working as a GED instructor at South Central Correctional Center in Licking, Missouri, and how humane treatment leads to better outcomes. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Here's Melvin and his guest. This is Jeff Humfeld. I'm sitting in for Melvin today, and our guest, as we said, is 22nd District Representative Brandon Ellington. Brandon, welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio.
How you doing today, Jeff?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. You guys have got off to a quick start down there, I think, in Jeff City. You've, of course, had the voter ID bill has been moving forward quickly, and then you also had a whole bunch of stuff come out from the governor's State of the Union speech. So why don't you give us some idea of what's been going on?
Well, I'm actually a little surprised with the quickness of the session this year. Like you said, the voter ID bill has already came out of committee. We heard it on the floor last week and voted out of the House on party lines. I believe it came out, the final vote tally was like 114 to 39. The votes wasn't shocking, but the fact that it came out so quick it was. We also been having ethics bills. We done heard several different ethics bills and legislations and amendments on the floor. We passed out one ethics bill that doesn't go real far, but it does have a year ban in there, but it doesn't really touch on campaign financial form or anything that we really see corruption in.
Well, can you even have, you know, affect the ethics of Jefferson City without doing something about campaign finance and the fact that we have no limits whatsoever on what can be given to a candidate?
I don't think you can. I think the only way to do it is to have campaign finance reform. Most people, when they hear about lobbyist gifts and legislative gifts, they have this assumption that lobbyists are buying people pearl necklaces and diamond rings and taking them on exotic vacations. That's not the case. You will see stuff getting donated to campaign funds for community events. You will see dinners and stuff like that. The scary part comes with the campaign finance. When you have somebody that gets $100,000 to $500,000, and in the case of the lieutenant governor, $1 million check, this is where the corruption and the impropriety comes in at. But they do a good job of spending it where most people believe that lobbyists are just taking legislators out. That's not the issue. The issue is the big-dollar campaign check. Rex Ziegfeld is a perfect example of that. And he gives a lot of people in the legislative body big checks. And then he expects things to get done that he won't. This is one of the reasons I believe we have the e-tax bill being filed by people out of Kansas City, outside of Kansas City and St. Louis.
One of the other things, and we'll stick with ethics here for just a moment, is the bill that was put forward that would require, I guess, legislators to report that they're having sex with a lobbyist or whatever, and report that as some kind of a contribution. What is that all about?
Again, that's another distracting piece of legislation, right? So the representative filed that. Basically, the bill states if a legislator has sex with a lobbyist, that they have to report it on their ethics report, but it has no monetary value. Well, it's not a lot of I don't know if people are really aware of what a lot of my colleagues look like. There's not a lot of sex for votes going on up there.
Okay.
It's not. So, again, that's something to distract people to create a problem without actually addressing a problem. Because the problem, again, is in campaign contributions. And I challenge anybody to just pull up Ziegfeld's name and see how many $5,000 checks he was giving people in the legislature. And you're going to see 10, 15, 25, 50, up to $1 million checks being written to individuals. This is where the corruption comes from. But again, these aren't the bills that we're talking about. We're talking about sex with legislators. That's not really happening from a lobbyist standpoint. we're talking about lobbyist gifts, which again has no monetary effect because somebody can take somebody to dinner and you can go sit down and you can have a steak dinner, but you can do a lot more with $250,000 in your campaign than you can do at that dinner. And that's what we need to be focusing in on.
Well, I agree. I think that this is one of the things where Missouri is looked at as kind of a laughing stock in some ways. All right. One of the other things that has been announced as area of interest this year in the legislature is transportation, and in particular a gas tax. Now the governor wants to see the gas tax raised. I think the Republican leadership even kind of realizes they're going to have to do something here. What do you see as possible possibility on that score?
I don't really see us doing the gas tax. I know the governor wants it. He mentioned in the state of speech, your assessment of Republican leadership is correct. They do know something has to be done, but the majority of the Republican body is opposed to raising the gas tax. So even though leadership understands that something seriously has to be done, I doubt we're going to do anything this year with the gas tax. We know we need more money for transportation. A lot of people are concerned about the infrastructure that has to be repaired in southwest Missouri after the floodings, et cetera. But I'd be shocked if we actually passed the gas tax because we're talking about a Republican-controlled body increasing taxes. And I really don't see that happening right now. The toll road is pretty much dead on arrival, so I don't see the toll road ideal happening either. And I really don't know what we're going to do. It's kind of similar to the real ID debate. We know we have to do something about it, but the majority of folks up there is hesitant to touch it.
Well, let's talk about the real ID debate and also the voter ID issue, which I think they're actually different issues. One is the IDs that are using Missouri state driver's licenses. We don't report to the federal government the information that we take when we get those licenses. So now we're not going to be able to get into federal buildings, and our driver's license won't be any good at the airport to get us onto the airplane, that type of thing. And then the voter ID is a whole different thing, and you might want to tell folks about your little play there that of course got voted down, but it was to let them know, hey, we know what you're doing here. So
yeah, it's just time to be honest and upfront, and even when we compare the real ID and the voter ID, we have huge flaws in ideology when it comes from the Republican Party. And I say the Republican Party because they control the conversation right now. With the real ID, we refuse to accept the federal government's recommendations for the things that we have to keep records on for people to have the real ID correspondence. Certain things we don't keep retention. We don't keep retention of people's photographs and information that they submit. Even though we have your photograph on file with your driver's license, if you're getting that reissued, we don't retain a lot of those records, birth certificates and other things of that nature, which is required in the real ID. But the lapse in ideology comes from the same Republican Party that's saying that people that want to vote have to jump through extra loopholes to prove who they are so they can exercise a right, as opposed to a privilege, which is driving, and we don't want to correspond with any of the regulations that would prove who people are. It makes no sense. And the floor thing, the floor movement that you were talking about is amendment. I offered an amendment on the voter ID bill to call it voter suppression, because the voter IDs, we know, would disenfranchise at least 250,000 people. We know that it would put a poll tax, and a poll tax, by definition, is anything that people have to pay for in order to vote. So we know by definition it implement a poll tax on everybody in the state of Missouri that they have to go buy an ID to exercise the right. We also know that it hasn't been any documented cases of voter impersonation at the polls since 1933. Like, we know this. This is documentation. The only cases of voter problems that we have is people that move outside of their district and then they go vote, where they're not impersonating anybody. They just didn't change their voter registration. So it's not even the same mustard that the Republicans are trying to blanket it with, where we have voter fraud. We don't have that. We haven't had a documented case since 1933. And again, that's why I seek to change the title of the bill, because it's not about voter ID, it's about voter suppression. Even the voter ID bill that they have, you'll see several newspaper articles and different commentaries where the representative said that they're going to pay for it. Well, if you actually read the bill, that's not what it says. It says subject to appropriation in May, which means that we would never fund the voter ID fund. And again, we would just be disenfranchising people.
Why don't we get to some of the bills that you think are going to make it forward, and some of the legislation that you're proposing yourself?
Well, this year I'm actually extremely optimistic about the ability to move some criminal justice reform bills. I checked the calendar last week, and I had 9 of my criminal justice bills have already been submitted to committee, which is a drastic difference than last year when Speaker Deal refused to refer. Well, not refer, but he refused to allow any criminal justice bills to advance to the floor. So I'm actually optimistic that we may see some expungement legislation passed this year. It's a senator working on some, a Republican senator working on some expungement legislation. And then I have a bill that's not 100% identical, but it has the same effect when he talks about nonviolent felonies being able to have the ability to get expunged. Also have a Criminal Justice Civil Rights Act bill that pretty much puts more teeth in what we already don't do in the state of Missouri, such as tallying the data, written consent form, which would be mandated for everybody that's pulled over. And if they don't sign the consent form, obviously the officer has to sign out that they didn't sign the consent. Just common sense legislation to actually give citizens teeth back if something illegal or their rights are violated.
Okay, one of the things that seems to be catching some attention in this field is the bill to do away with the death penalty, and that's being put forward by a Republican for the first time in the Missouri legislature in a long, long time. So you know, want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was actually, I believe it was Senator Whelan that filed that bill. And I was a little bit shocked, not necessarily by the senator, but by the fact that the Republicans are finally coming out against the death penalty when they come out against abortion. Because it's almost the same when you talk about the value of human life, not necessarily the crime that somebody committed to get the death penalty, but the value of human life. So I was actually surprised that he filed that bill. With the death penalty bill interpretations at the state, obviously you have a lot of people that's against it. In my knowledge, it hasn't been a Republican in previous years that has ever filed one. So I'm curious to see how far it's going to advance. The sentiment from my own personal experience, I think it's enough sentiment in the House to actually get rid of the death penalty. But again, this is the first year I've actually seen a Republican file this, so I'm extremely curious to see what's going to happen with the bill.
Well, and the interesting thing is that, you know, the Republicans that are bringing this forward are bringing it forward for different reasons than the people that have been fighting against the death penalty for a number of years. So maybe there's going to be some strange bedfellows here, and actually something happened. We'll see, I guess.
Well, that's what makes it interesting, Jeff, and it's the same with the 85% and the 40% bill. I'm about to tell my colleagues that has been animally against what I consider common sense reforms, actually starting to understand the conversation. And again, this year I think we have the ability to kind of move stuff. It's election year, so election year is always tricky, and anything can happen when you talk about partisan politics and partisan politics blocking stuff. But it's extremely encouraging to see different aspects actually starting to work on these types of legislation now.
All right. Why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the bills that you're actually putting forward? We've got a few minutes here yet, so.
Okay. I got the some of the bills that I think I shouldn't have a problem moving is the removal of the statute of limitation for sexual victims of child abuse and sexual molestation. I actually think that bill should be able to go through without any implications. The written consent form is actually a bill I've been talking to a lot of my Republican colleagues to make sure I can get their support. And basically what that bill does is if somebody gets pulled over and they're stopped by law enforcement, it's a written consent form. This directly DOJ findings and the Ferguson report findings, even though I didn't file this bill for that, it addresses a lot of the issues that they had as far as people getting pulled over, retaliated against, some people's rights getting violated without any documentation. Another bill that I have that we're working on is the expungement bills, the nonviolent and the violent expungement bills. I also have the legalization for marijuana that I'm working on again. The minimum wage bill. The minimum wage bill would actually raise it up to $10.25. And this year, the Democrats is actually getting behind raising the minimum wage. I'm still waiting on the city to, which is ridiculous, but I can get into that later. Let me see. The eyewitness protection bill. The utility protection bill is something that I want to talk about, too. I have a utility protection bill that I filed this year that would mandate utility companies cannot gouge people prices, so they wouldn't be able to charge people over $10 to recut their services on. So they wouldn't be able to charge half of the bill or ungouge.
I do have a question on the eyewitness protection bill. Why don't you explain that purpose of that bill is and what you're trying to do with that?
Well, basically, the eyewitness protection bill is an innocent project idea, and what it does is standardize. When we look at eyewitness lineups, we know that there's various issues with eyewitness statements, eyewitness recantations, if that's a word. So basically what I'm trying to do is standardize the practice, and it goes from everything to the way the lineup is actually implemented, the type of individuals that would actually be in the lineup, descriptions where you can't just have two people that don't resemble each other at all. In the lineup, you actually have to have people that resemble each other, height, weight, race, etc. So basically, it just standardizes the process, and it should get rid of a lot of the imbalances that happen. And the bill actually helps both. It helps prosecutors, it helps defense. Prosecutors by cleaning up the law eyewitness process, and it helps the defense erroneous lineup.
What else do you see as being something that has a chance of passing? I know that I heard something that right to work is not necessarily something that they're going to be working on this year.
Well, it could be a right to work sleeper. Currently, we have Representative Courtney Curtis. He's a Democrat, and he's also a member of the Black Caucus. He's actually filed a right to work bill again this year. He filed one last year, and he's filed one this year. And I know Representative Holly has filed, the union bill. I can't remember the name of her bill right now, but the bill that actually goes out the union dues that will require written consent each year for the unions to be able to collect people dues that have already opted into the union. So it is a couple right-to-work sleeper bills that are out there that may just have some momentum to move. Last year, the right-to-work bill came out of the House with over 100-something Republican votes, and it had 92 or 93 votes during the veto override, and it only needs 108 votes to be overridden. So it's enough numbers up there for that bill to actually have some potential danger to it. The same with the union due bill.
Okie doke. What else is there that you really think is going to make some headway, good or bad?
I think the ethics bill will continue to make headway. Depends on what happens in the Senate. But if they keep that one clean, that one may actually pass, and it'll be the first year in I don't know how many years that they've been talking about ethics reform that we actually have an ethics reform bill that makes it to the governor's desk. Economically wise, I haven't seen really any bills that deals with the economy yet. The same with transportation. I do expect something to come about, but I have no idea what that something would be. And again, that would be presented by leadership. probably on the Republican side when it comes to the transportation. Medicaid is dead. I do think we can get some criminal justice reform bills done, but it just depends on how clean they stand. What I mean by clean is how many amendments are actually attached to the bill. And in their current forms, they're actually looking healthy and looking like they can make it through the process, as long as they're not weighted down by not smart ideas. I had to watch what I say, Jeff.
I understand. Why don't we talk just a little bit? We've, in the last two or three years, have seen some really strong efforts by citizen groups to come to the Capitol and lobby. And maybe you want to talk a little bit about the need for that, or you know, whether that's going to be effective, or you know, why that's an important thing.
No, it's a necessity. One of the negatives that I have about being at the Capitol is almost everything we do is in the dark, right? So if you pay attention to city politics, you can look on Channel 2, and you can see city committee hearings. You can see what they're doing on the floor. You actually have a chance to see what's going on. At the state, everything is done in the dark. We're not broadcast. Our committees aren't broadcast. They're not taped. So people have no clue what their representatives are actually fighting for, talking about, and or how they're voting. So when we have citizens that come up there, it does two things. It puts immediate attention on representatives, especially depending on the district that people are coming from, and it puts a human face on stuff. What we see more often than not is lobbyists, big CEOs, and lawyers that have interest in certain legal changes that come up there and they advocate for their clients or what they want changed in the law. But the people that the laws actually affect, we very rarely see them. So now I can use the cannabis oil bill as an example. I sat on that committee. It was pretty much every Republican was against passing the cannabis oil until we had a committee hearing. We had 3 hours and 30 minutes of testimony in favor. We had women that brought their children up there that was in wheelchairs, that had epilepsy and the whole nine. And that bill passed. And it passed because it was a human face put on there. When we talk about people coming up to the Capitol protesting, y'all should. This is what the State House is for. The State House in Missouri, we have no restrictions for people to come up. We have no metal detectors. We have no people patting you down at doors. And that's because the mantra of the Capitol is that it's supposed to be open to all citizens. But then we have a problem with citizens actually understanding that and using their rights to come up there and protest and lobby for what they want. It's extremely important. Extremely important. I wish more people had the courage and gumption to come up there and to protest and to say we're not going to accept this from our government. And well, you see things change quickly.
Yeah, we'd love to continue on, but our time is through for today. We will get back with you later in the session. We want to remind everyone that after these messages, you will hear the Jaws of Justice calendar. Thank you, Brandon.
No, thank you, Jeff.
Now, the calendar for January 25th, 2016. The ACLU of Missouri invites you to join their Voices for Liberty Lobby Day at the Missouri State Capitol on Wednesday, February 10th. To register and find out about transportation, send an email to outreach@aclu-mo.org. outreach@aclu-mo.org. By tomorrow, Tuesday, January 26th. At Lobby Day, you'll meet with your legislators as a citizen lobbyist, learn about the legislative process, and hear what legislation the ACLU is tracking in 2016. The KCMO chapter of the NAACP is hosting another session by the KC Election Board to train folks to become deputy registrars and register people to vote. Participants must be 18 years of age and live in Kansas City, Missouri, and Jackson County. With this being a presidential election year, the need for registrars is critical to ensure everyone has the opportunity to vote. The training will take place at Ebenezer AME Church, 3808 Cleveland Avenue. please RSVP by tomorrow, Tuesday, January 26th, by emailing to naacpkcmo@sbcglobal.net or by calling 816-421-1191. You are invited to join More Squared as they bring together people of goodwill for an honest conversation about race and white privilege in our community. Racism is experienced in many ways. Let's work together to make a change. You can join them Thursday, January 28th, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Trinity UMC, 620 East Armor Boulevard, KCMO. Space is limited, so reserve your spot soon. For more information and reservations, send an email to Ed Kale, that's edkail69@gmail.com. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found at the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Next week is the KKFI on-air pledge drive, and Jaws of Justice Radio will be starting at about 9:20 a.m. instead of our normal 9 a.m. Please tune in and call in your pledge of support for KKFI and Jaws of Justice Radio when host Craig LeBeau will talk with Frank Smith of Private Corrections Institute about their fight to eliminate private prisons. That's 9:20 a.m. next Monday. Now we join Keith Brownell and his guest Caroline McGinnis.
Good morning. As you just heard a few minutes ago, my interview today will be with Miss Caroline Giamatto, who is a high school teacher, former employee of the Missouri Department of Corrections, and recently the author of a book entitled Banknotes, the True Story of the Boonie Hat Bandit. She joins our show today to voice her concerns about the failure of the criminal justice system and the corruption that exists within the Missouri Department of Corrections. And she has a lot to say that should be regarded as worthwhile to those with a serious interest in these subjects. My name is Keith Brownell. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio.
Good morning, Ms. Giamatto.
Yes, good morning.
Could you give our audience a little background before we get started about yourself and how you came to be involved in these various projects?
Yes, I may be considered kind of an unusual spokesperson for criminal justice issues. I grew up in a law enforcement family. My dad was a deputy when I was growing up, and I grew up in a very conservative part of Missouri. But my family also was always interested in criminal justice issues, and it was part of dinner time conversation. I grew up in and out of the courthouse. I knew all the town attorneys by first name as a kid. I was in and out of the sheriff's department. You know, I knew law enforcement. I understood the criminal justice system from a very young age. And when I graduated from high school, I went to the University of Arizona, got my degree in political science. So I've always had an interest and our government, criminal justice, how it works. And back in July of 2011, I was hired by the Department of Corrections here in Missouri to be an academic teacher 3, which would mean that I would be teaching the GED program, which is required for all inmates in Missouri who have not attained either a high school diploma or a GED already. So that is how I first got involved with being in the Department of Corrections.
All right. Could you tell us a little bit about this book that you have written?
Yes. Banknotes, the True Story of the Boonie Hat Bandit. It follows the events of a very high-profile case out of St. Louis. And the region and even the nation was captivated for a while. In 2007 to 2008, there were a series of 12 bank robberies in the St. Louis area. And people were wondering, what's going on? This is crazy. The Boonie Hat Bandit would go into a bank, slip a note to the teller, and quietly leave. And nobody had a clue who he was. When he was arrested, people were even more surprised by who it was rather than just the crimes themselves. It was Keith Giamanco. He was a middle-class dad next door, independent stock trader, who had fallen on hard times during the economic recess. And out of desperation, he had begun robbing banks. And the FBI agent who arrested him even said that if he had stopped at robbery number 11, they never would have caught him because they had no clue who he was. So it made quite a few headlines, but he would never speak to the press or explain what led a middle-class dad to become a notorious criminal. This story tells the story of what motivated him to turn to crime, how that can happen to a regular person. It's not a glorification of the crime. It doesn't go into depth about each and every crime that happened because that wasn't the point of the story. It follows Keith through the court system and what can happen to you if you go into a court system without any money and you rely on either a pro bono attorney or the public defender system. And it also follows him into a maximum security prison and shows what it's really like on the inside of the prison.
Can you talk a little bit about the hard times that he fell upon, what made him turn from being an independent stock trader into a life of crime?
Yes. A lot of people in 2007, 2008 started having their financial lives spiral out of control. Keith was no different. He had gone from being extremely successful. He was making a good income for himself and his twin daughters that he had custody of. And as the economic downturn took effect, it just started spiraling farther and farther downward for him. And he had tried to refinance his house, but as we all remember, the housing bubble had burst and his house was worth less than what his mortgage was. And so he couldn't get any relief there. It was a series of personal and financial instances of desperation that caused him to do something that he never would have considered doing before. I mean, one of his best friends was a lifelong police officer who now works for the Department of Homeland Security. And Keith wasn't the kind of person that you would assume would turn to crime. And he made some mistakes, and he feels terribly about those. He realizes in hindsight that he probably didn't need to worry as much about what other people were going to think if he was seen as a financial failure, that his daughters would have still loved him, as they have proven, to unconditionally love him, even if he doesn't have any money. But it was a hard lesson for him to learn. And I think it's something, while most of us don't turn to bank robbery, it's something that we can relate to in worrying about if we can't provide for our children. We look at our children, and especially if we're a single parent, if we lose our job or if something happens that causes a financial disaster in the family, we look at our children and we say, how am I going to take care of you? And this weighed heavily on him.
How long did you work for the Department of Corrections?
2.5 years.
And did you learn anything while you worked there that you didn't know before you started becoming an employee?
Everyone hears that prison is dangerous. Everybody knows that it's a dangerous situation to be in. I know when I would tell people that I worked at a maximum security prison, I usually got two responses. One was, are you crazy? And the other one was, aren't you afraid? What I learned while working there was that, yes, there are some very dangerous people who are in prison. I'd say about 20% of the prison population are the kind of people that you definitely don't want to find on a well-lit street, let alone a dark alley. And they're a concern for even the other inmates who are in a prison system. Then there are a number of people, I'd say about 40% of the prison population, are people who were almost predetermined to end up in prison, unfortunately. There's generational incarceration that happens where these guys, their grandparents went to prison, their parents have been in prison, their aunts, their uncles, their brothers, their sisters have been in prison, and they come from a neighborhood. I had one student who looked at me just with complete disbelief when I had to explain to him, no, not every kid grows up running drugs for their parents. And it was like he had never even considered this to be a possibility. And so there's a number of people, like I said, about 40%, who, because of the neighborhood that they grow up in, they are almost in that preschool to prison pipeline, that are just destined to be there. If they had grown up in a different circumstance, in a different setting, they never would have been in prison in the first place. Then you have another set of people who, if you put them in civilian clothes and they were sitting next to you in a restaurant or in line with you at the grocery store, you would never even know it because they were just regular people who made mistakes. As I used to tell my students in prison, everybody makes mistakes. Some mistakes land you in prison, and some don't. One of the stories that I used to tell my students is that, for example, if someone robbed me, if they stole my car, that's a terrible inconvenience for me, and my insurance company isn't going to be very happy with it either. And if that person gets caught, they're going to prison. But there are a lot of people in society who do things that are wrong, that are more damaging to society as a whole. For example, you can have the businessman who gets dressed every day in his suit and goes off to work, and he's a member of the Chamber of Commerce. He's on a church council, and everybody thinks, oh, he is a great guy. But that same guy might be going home at night emotionally damaging and destroying his children as people, belittling them, berating them. And maybe he doesn't lay a hand on them, but just the way he cuts them down causes them to be broken people. And then those children go out in the world and get into broken relationships or don't deal with society in the right ways. And I would say that he has done more damage to society than the person who robbed my individual car. But the way the legal system is set up, and this is just the way society is, certain things get you sent to prison and others don't. But it doesn't mean that everybody doesn't make a mistake that they really wish they could take back in life. Everybody does that.
Okay, now what institution did you work at when you were employed by the DOC?
I taught at the South Central Correctional Center in Wicking, Missouri.
Now, how did you come to be acquainted with this person that you wrote the book about?
I actually hired him to work as a tutor in my classroom.
And how did your name come to be Giamano?
Keith and I are in a relationship, and we aren't officially married yet, but I wrote it under Giamanco because of the certainty we have that we will get married someday. And also, this is not going to be my last book. I wanted to make sure that the name was consistent on future publications.
Okay, now you said he worked for you as a tutor at the school.
Yes.
And I think we talked on the phone yesterday and you told me about some experiences that you had with some of the other prisoners who were working also in the school. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yes. Well, first of all, I wanted to say that my first insight into the concept that it's not always easy to tell the good guys from the bad guys inside our corrections facilities is when I was very first hired, I had to do a drug test. The corrections officer who was in charge of doing the drug tests told me, you're going to have a lot of people tell you that inmates are going to be silver-tongued devils, they're going to lie, they're going to manipulate, they're going to try to coerce you into doing things. But he said, you need to understand that you're going to have to watch out for those same things from staff members. The inmates are not the only ones who are going to try to manipulate you or sweet-talk you into doing things. You're going to have to keep your eyes open that the other staff is just as likely to do that. And so that really opened my eyes. And then after I'd been hired for 3 weeks, I was sent away to Jefferson City to go through the four-week training academy that all DOC employees go through. And many of the instructors were professional. They were wanting people to learn how to do things the right way. But there were a couple of people, and one in particular that I remember, who would say things like, well, the policy says that you do things this way, but wink, wink, this is how you really do it. And then he would tell supposedly funny little stories about how you could really get at an inmate and antagonize them by you and all of your buddies who were on duty at the same time, say, stopping that same inmate and searching him every step of the way on the way to the chow hall, and how funny that was. Or you could have competitions over who had written up the most inmates during that shift. And these things happened at South Central. I saw this in action where guards would have competitions and they would be talking about it over their open radio so that other staff members heard this happening. And inmates could hear that it was happening. And that's an extremely destructive thing to have go on when human beings are being treated as entertainment simply because you have leverage or power or authority over them to do it to them. Because one of the things that stood out to me that was most troubling about this is that, first of all, our taxpayer dollars are paying the salaries of these people. It costs not one dime more for us to pay somebody to act professionally than it does for someone who is treating people as entertainment or as something to get some kind of pleasure out of torturing or tormenting. When you are told from the time you go to the academy that, wink, wink, this is what you're really doing, ha-ha, isn't this funny to do this to someone, it's really easy for, especially a brand-new employee, say somebody who's 20 years old who has just been hired by the Department of Corrections, to have that sink into their subconscious that that's acceptable, it's appropriate to do that. And so as taxpayers, we're paying for people to behave that way. As citizens, we also pay later when that person gets out of prison. If someone is 19 when they go to prison and they're in for 20 years, and what they are taught by example is that if you have the upper hand over someone, you have that authority, you can do whatever you want to them. That becomes ingrained in their own psyche. And so when they're released from prison, they get out and suddenly they might feel that they're the one that has the upper hand over someone. And suddenly your life, your children's life, your neighbor's life isn't as valuable to that person as it should be. And it's because we, as taxpayers, have paid for them to be trained that way. We need to actually be looking at the Department of Corrections to do what its name says, to be correcting. We're not using this golden opportunity that we have. Okay, somebody was on the wrong track. Somebody has a wrong thought process. They do something terrible and they end up in prison. 97% of all Missouri inmates will be back out on the street at some point. Very few people actually have the key thrown away when they're locked up. Almost everybody does get out at some time. And it's a matter of what kind of product do we want coming out the other end for all of our tax dollars, because it's, at the very least, the conservative number is $23,000 a year for each inmate that we incarcerate. And I would like to think, as a taxpayer, that we're getting a better product out the other side than someone who has been taught all the wrong ways of going about society. Because if you're 19 when you go in and you're in for 20 years, that person's only a adult experience in a society is the prison experience, and we need to be making that something that is as conducive to their release and success on the outside as a productive member of society as possible, or else it's just a continuation of the cycle of victimization. Because if we don't teach them not to victimize, then when they get out, they're not going to know anything other than victimizing.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill. This is Jaws of Justice, and you're listening to an interview that I'm conducting with Miss Caroline Giamano about her recent book, Banknotes, The True Story of the Boneyhead Bandit. And we are talking about the corruption that exists within the Missouri Department of Corrections and the failure of the judicial system. Okay, now, you spoke a while ago about the officer advising you about the staff members who would try to sweet talk you and approach you with different things that didn't have anything to do with your job. Did you have an experience or any experiences like that while you were employed in the Department of Corrections?
Yes, I did. I mean, there were a lot of daily comments that were made, but one of the things that sticks out the most in my mind is this one time the weather was turning bad and there'd been a lot of rain, and I had a lengthy drive to get to where I lived from the prison. And I called back to the prison and asked if I could speak to someone who I knew had just come into work from my same area of the state, just to make sure what the road conditions were. And when I called in, I got called into what's called the administrative bubble. And the officer, he was a lieutenant, who answered the phone when I said that I needed to talk to so-and-so because I wanted to check on road conditions, he actually, on the phone, propositioned me and said, well, you know, you could just stay at my house tonight. I was just appalled. And, of course, I said, no, thank you. Just put me through to the person I need to talk to. There's just this cavalier attitude amongst some of the corrections officers that that would be wanted or acceptable. And Paul Harvey actually years ago made a statement about the Missouri Department of Corrections, which his family had had some involvement in. And Paul Harvey said that if you want to see the worst of what society has to offer, sit in the staff parking lot at shift change at a prison. Sadly, in some ways, that's true, because there is a lot of bad behavior that goes on, and that's kind of a dirty little secret amongst staff members that the department doesn't really want out there, but they have a sizable amount of issues with people not behaving the way they should on duty or shortly after duty. There are a lot of good people who work there. There really are. I am not saying that every person who works for the Department of Corrections is a bad person or has bad morals or doesn't go to work trying to do their best job. There are a lot of people who work for the Department of Corrections who are good, honest, hardworking people. However, what happens is when you have a system that allows bad behavior to happen and there's more than one bad apple per bushel in the Department of Corrections, the way the prisons are located in our state, they are in rural areas. Usually they are the primary employment opportunity for that area. We used to have 5,000 inmates in Missouri, and pretty much everybody was at what was called the Walls in Jefferson City. That was in the 1980s. With the expansion of things like the 85% mandatory minimums and the broadening of statutes to include more people in those lengthy sentences, our prison population has exploded, and we now have 22 prisons in the state of Missouri, and most of those prisons are located in rural areas. If you are someone who depends on that $29,000 a year corrections officer one job, and that's what you're using to support your family, you've lived in that area for years, and you don't have any other economic opportunities. Unfortunately, there is a human predisposition for a lot of people to just bite their tongue, go to work, not say anything about anything that they see that isn't proper, especially if it's happening with someone who's been there for a long time or who is in a position of authority. And unfortunately, a lot of good people don't say anything about something that's wrong because they can't afford to lose their job. And that does happen to people. People who have spoken up against someone in authority at the prison who is doing something that they shouldn't, they've lost their jobs. It's a well-known fact that that does happen. You know, you report somebody for sexual harassment, and suddenly you're on the bad list.
Does the Department of Corrections have a sexual harassment policy?
Of course they do, but it's like the wink, wink, nudge, nudge guy at the training academy. Just because it's on the books doesn't mean that it actually gets followed through on. That's what a lot of the problem is that if you talk to anyone in Jefferson City, they will tell you, well, our policy says this, and so this is the way it is. But the de facto reality is that that's not what happens inside the institutions.
Well, we certainly enjoyed talking to you and doing this interview. Perhaps at some future point we can get you back on the station again, because you have a lot of information that needs to be shared with the public. We want to wish you success on your book and continue to keep doing what you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And, yeah, Banknotes, The True Story of the Benny Hat Bandit, goes into detail about things that I think people in the public really need to understand happen inside a corrections system.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following is part of a discussion I had with Mr. Phil Smith, a reporter with Alternet and the Drug War Chronicle. We're talking about his latest story.
Well, it's a story I did about some research results. There are some scientists at Brown University who are trying to find a pharmaceutical cure for marijuana dependence. So they did a pilot study with an epilepsy drug. They've also been experimenting with for use in treating cocaine addiction and some other addictions. But what they found in their pilot study was that the drug they wanted to cure pot addiction with was, the cure was worse than the disease. They had a study of 66 young people who claimed they were dependent on cannabis, even though some of them are only using it twice a week. And half of them didn't even meet the clinical diagnosis of cannabis dependence. But nonetheless, they all participated in this program. They could come up with no reduction in the frequency of marijuana smoking by the subjects of the study, but they did come up with a slight reduction in the total consumption, difference of 0.2 grams per smoking session, which they called statistically significant, but in my mind, you know, that's a couple of tokes.
You know, we do a weekly segment on the Cultural Baggage Show called Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. And besides the effect of maybe lowering the amount per usage, which to me sounds like they're getting better benefit out of the weed, I'm not sure. But it also, and some of the other complications, including a strange feeling. What's your thought?
They had side effects including depression, anxiety, loss of bodily control, and, quote, unusual sensations. Now, these side effects were so dire that half of the people quit the study before it even got done. The whole thing makes me think about the utility of dealing with a relatively benign dependence on marijuana by treating it with harsh pharmaceutical drugs. I mean, it just seems sort of nonsensical to me.
Well, Phil, I don't know what to say except, you know, you heard my thought. That the drug war is just a fairy tale, very grim fairy tale, no nexus to logic. And I think that's proven itself every day as we go forward. Your closing thoughts, Mr. Phil Smith.
Well, one thing I want to say is that there's money in it. I mean, these researchers got funded to do this research, just like, you know, law enforcement gets funding to carry on its role in the drug war. It's not just about how we deal with drugs. It's also about a lot of people making a lot of money. You can always check out the stuff that I write as well as other stuff I find on the web at alternet.org/drugs.
Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Liam, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.